Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Prep Kitchen Podcast, the podcast where Matt and I talk all things food, cookery and hospitality. Please don't forget to like, rate and subscribe to never miss an episode.
Welcome.
We're back
again.
We're back.
In the same house, in the same room.
We're in
the
same room
time
this time.
Ever. And for those of people that will be watching on YouTube, it may look like more of a counselling session by how we're actually set up here, but we'll try not to delve too deep into the psychological implications of the culinary industry and what effect it's had on us.
That's why we're here, isn't it?
That's pretty much why we're here. So how you been, Chief?
I'm all right, yeah.
It's been a while.
It's been a crazy time, isn't it?
It's been a while. Was it now 7 months since we were last on
together.
The airwaves?
Yeah, I put out that video last week about the hospitality crisis.
Yeah.
We're just doing crazy numbers because we're viral now. We're celebrities almost.
Some would say, yeah.
But yeah, it's been so busy.
Yeah, that's partly why the issue is we've not been able to get back and do a weekly or bi-weekly podcast because we've just been too busy.
We wanted to, for sure.
And
we brought it out multiple times.
Multiple times, but we're just never able to find the right time. Because obviously, once the COVID restrictions were lifted and summertime came, it was a busy period for both
balls to the wall.
You
time,
and
really.
I, yeah.
And we had a record-breaking summer.
Yeah. How many covers were you doing on a day on average?
I wouldn't even like to put a number on it.
No.
At least 800.
At least 800. Some days you cleared 1,500.
Yeah, 2,000 almost. Yeah. I think one day.
Not quite the same for us where we are. But we might do that in a week. Which was pretty good going, I suppose, yeah. And now it brings us to Christmas time, which is always, I think for a lot of chefs and a lot of people in hospitality, it's a challenging time of year. It's difficult. It's hard work. It's a lot of demanding people.
Yeah.
But it's kind of been stopped in its tracks somewhat from going as hectic as it normally would because of the situation we now find ourselves in again. I know you've had issues with cancellations.
Cancellations, yeah. Last minute cancellations has just been a nightmare, obviously, because you get a party of 12 booked. You order in enough stuff.
And then they don't turn up.
And then three of them cancel 45 minutes before.
Yeah. And it's been in the news, or certainly the news that we'll be reading, quite a lot over the last couple of days, noticing that there's some big heavyweights of the culinary world that have had the same problems that we've had, and they've had it almost as bad. I mean, I saw on Instagram the other day, Tom Kerridge had 650 plus cancellations in the last
six days.
There's another restaurant in London, 100 cancellations in a singular day.
Yeah.
And where's it going to stop? And it's the knock-on effect that we spoke of many times before. But if it continues, and people are reluctant to want to go out because of the fear, and the understandable fear of a new variant. You know, what happens to people's jobs? What happens to the supply chain? You know, you're going to be ordering in less stuff. You're not going to be as busy. You're not going to need as much staff as what you'd normally need. And for us, especially being more rural, going into the quiet time of the year, I see it being a real rough ride for the next couple of months.
I think it's going to be tough. I really do. Going into the new year, I think it's just going to be a nightmare. And, you know, reflecting back sort of 6 months when we reopened and we were so busy. Like, I've never seen hospitality that busy before.
Mm.
It was just crazy. And then...
Can you see it being like a repeat? Because everyone was shut down last winter.
I can see...
It was slowly taken off, wasn't it, come March, April?
I can see it getting really quiet again. Probably till about March time, and then I can see everything just reopening again. And I hope this isn't going to be a yearly thing now.
No, and you get inundated with
where you
people
just get
who
absolutely fucked for
haven't been out for
months.
A couple of months, and then you get spanked. And also finding staff.
That's been the biggest headache.
That's
of
been
my
a
life.
Headache for. It's going to be a headache for me certainly. We're now going into the quiet time of year, January, February, where we are very rural. It's going to get quiet. We have to find two, maybe three more chefs. But there's not going to be the work there for them January and February.
Yeah.
So what do you do? Do you chance it and do you wait out till March until you're busier? Or do you want someone in there or a couple of people in there earlier so they can sort of hit the ground running by the time the busy period comes along. I know I prefer to have a couple of people in, yeah, at least by February. If you could coax them in and say, listen, there's not really the hours here at the minute, but can you do a couple of days, you know, get to know the kitchen, get to know the way we work. But if it was like last time, trying to find chefs for the spring and summer just gone, we were not exactly inundated with CVs. Yeah. And
I don't think it's trying to find staff. I think it's trying to find, you know, decent staff.
Yeah.
Is the more difficult issue.
Yeah.
People that want to come into work,
yeah,
come into work on time.
Hmm.
Just want to do the job.
Yeah. I've always said I'd much rather take someone with less experience but who really wants to learn over someone who perhaps thinks they know it all already.
You've done that.
Yeah.
Friend of the podcast.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm hopeful that we can find some people to fit in, but I just have a funny feeling it's going to be a really tough couple of months, and things are changing weekly. I mean, we've discussed, haven't we, about the potential of a lockdown.
January.
Lockdown 5 or whatever it would be.
No.
I've got absolutely no idea. But it's going to prove to be pretty tough. And for a lot of people, it's going to be, you know, a case of can they even survive? Can they even get through? If this busy time of year is kind of what, if, you know, let's say, for example, you work in a place which is quite seasonal. So you have a really good summer and then end of October, November, you're quite quiet. And then you bank on December and Christmas being really busy.
Yeah.
So you kind of got that little buffer there for January, February when you're quiet. And if Christmas, you know, I suppose saying it's been decimated is a bit too much of a strong word, but it's certainly been pretty catastrophic for some places. If you don't have that buffer, then January and February, you're thinking, you know, can I survive and through till March? And for some places, sadly, I'm not quite sure they're going to be able to do it. So there needs to be something put in place. If we are going to go into a lockdown, if we're not going to go into a lockdown, something needs to be done, I think. Obviously, I'm talking financially. It's going to mean that some of these places can survive.
Yeah.
If it means that they have to run on limited numbers and they can't, you know, perhaps find the work to keep all the staff there, is there a way in which the government can introduce a sort of part furlough where they can cover, you know, 40, 50% of salaries? I don't know. I really don't know. But it's going to be a telling time.
It's a tough one.
Yeah.
And it's going to, you know, exacerbate the mental health struggle that's already going on.
Oh.
I saw an article the other day about mental health in the hospitality industry is peaking again.
Yeah.
You know, you haven't got the hours, you can't pay the bills, you haven't got the customers.
Yeah.
All these things have a knock-on effect, and I'm not sure whether actually something's going to give. And I remember saying this before, but something is actually going to have to give this time.
Hmm.
And I'm, you know, again, I don't know what it is, but.
And there's also the chefs that left the industry during the first lockdown and the second lockdown. If there's another one that comes along, you know, how many more are we going to lose? How many more people are going to think, you know what, this has now become sort of untenable going forward. I can't maintain a decent income for an industry that's going to be open, closed, up and down, and, you know. As I just said, we can't afford to lose any more people. We need them pretty badly at the minute. And unfortunately, some of our European friends have been told to bugger off back home.
Yeah, that's...
Which hasn't helped.
Yeah.
It really hasn't helped.
Yeah.
Because they were, you know, certainly in the bigger cities, a substantial number of the workforce. And that's been... And they've gone. And who's going to replace them?
Yeah,
and how are you going to entice them? It goes even deeper than that. I don't delve into it too much now, but it goes deeper. How are you then going to entice the next generation, the teenagers that are coming out of school, going into college, to then find them places in the workplace?
Yeah.
Are they going to be getting thrown up the ladder too high too soon because they need to make up the numbers, and then there's a potential that they may not get handled and managed and trained in the right way and make it disillusioned because they're having too much asked of them? I mean, I've had that problem. I wouldn't say the problem, but... the difficulty of the staff that I've got, I mean, I can't speak highly enough of them. They're fantastic. They've been so good from the word go. But I felt so guilty time after time of asking more of them than what I should be.
Yeah.
Because we haven't got the bodies on the ground with necessarily the amount of experience. We're having to rely on people. I mean, luckily for me, I've got away with it because I've found a couple of real gems. But there's going to be some people that aren't going to be as lucky as me. People getting thrown in at the deep end, yeah, and they can't handle it. So it's really going to be quite a troubling couple of months ahead. I don't quite know what to expect. Is that your mum making sure you're all right?
No, that's just the news.
That's just the news.
I thought we could have hot off the press hospitality news, but it's just about some sexual predator.
Yeah. But, you know, it's going to be a suck it and see couple of months. But I don't want the whole...
Come on, it's Christmas.
I don't want the whole podcast to be, oh God, everything's shit. We're a complete mess. You know, it is Christmas time. Sometimes it's one of the best times of year to work, actually. Because everyone tends to pull that little bit harder.
Oh, I've really enjoyed together. This Christmas.
Yeah, is it because it's been quiet?
No, it hasn't actually. No. But just to be back cooking again is a joy.
Yeah.
I don't know why. This Christmas has just been a pleasure to work. Yeah. I think everybody's just happy to be out having Christmas parties again.
Yeah.
That sort of bleeds through into the kitchen. And
It's always a nice atmosphere working at Christmas time.
You have that hour where I start stomping around because the smoked salmon hasn't been taken out of the fridge or whatever. But
Such is
life, Chief. Yeah.
Well, no, last year the Christmas parties, they were kind of stifled, weren't they? Because there was only a certain amount of people you can have on the table, X, Y, Z, you know, up and down all the time with masks on. Everything was table service, that kind of thing. But there is definitely, certainly the place where I work, there's a bit more atmosphere.
Yeah, we've had a lot of student parties this year.
Yeah, you can really sense
because we've got the space.
We're starting to get back to some kind of normal, which is just, it makes it even more of a shame that the circumstances that have arisen have done so at this time. But, you know, with any luck, we'll get through it. And I think every single time there's been an obstacle in the way, hospitality's kind of, you know, gelled together and they've bounced back and they've overcome these hurdles. The way that businesses in the first lockdown were able to sort of evolve and offer takeaways and all different kinds of services and meals at home, you know, it's shown that there's a real resilience there. And those people that really want to stick at it and really want to be part of this business have shown their true colours. So I'm hoping that's just going to sort of show itself again and we're going to show exactly what we're made of.
Yeah, and we can come back fighting.
But there has been, this time of year, which I think is one of the things in the television chef's calendar, which is always welcome this time of year, has been MasterChef The Professionals.
Yeah, because there's nothing better than finishing a 12-hour shift.
No, I know. It's funny, isn't it? You think, I've just cooked X amount of meals. I've spent 12-plus hours on my feet. I'm going to go home now and I'm going to watch some other people cook. But, you know, we get stuck into it every year. And it is a show that I do enjoy. I think it's really good. I think, actually, it's given a platform for so many chefs over the years who have gone on to do really good things. I think Marcus Waring and Monica Galletti are great on the show. I think they work really good as a duo.
Greg?
I don't mind Greg, actually. I think he plays a foil. I don't think he's as unknowledgeable as he sort of gives out, but he has to be that foil to the experts. You know, if it seems that he knows as much as the other two chefs, then he's almost redundant. So in the skills test when they
he loves an adjective,
yeah, he does love an adjective. But in the skills test sort of scenario, when they're both giving it the old, I want you to make an Italian meringue, whatever it might be, and then he goes, "Is that the one where you get the sugar and you just pour it in?" It's like he obviously knows that's not what it is, but he has to put the question forward for the people who, I suppose, at home aren't as knowledgeable, and then they go, "Oh no, it isn't. It's actually X, Y, Z." But this year, I think it's been a pretty decent show, actually.
Yeah,
you know, I think overall there's been it started off, and I think we both agreed the first few episodes, it didn't look to be the strongest pool of chefs I don't think they'd ever had.
This year, no.
But I think as the show has gone on, actually, there's been a couple of real talents that have come to the front. And I think
I really like to see on there that the chefs turning, really developing and coming into their own. And I think, as you said, this year, you're like, oh, fucking hell, they're a bit of a dodgy bunch this year.
Yeah.
But actually, the ones that have been whittled down now,
yeah,
you can see are really starting to come into their own and their own cookery and... It's actually really nice to see.
I think perhaps what it might have been this year, and it's just by pure fluke, I think, there's been some really good chefs and some not so good ones and nothing really in the middle. There's been too great of a chasm, and it's just how it's panned out between the really good chefs and the rest of them. There's been no one in the middle who you're thinking, he's got a little bit about him or she's got a little bit about her, and you know, maybe they might progress, and there hasn't been that kind of middle ground. But there's one of the chefs on there who I know. I don't say I know him as a friend, but he's got himself into the finals, which has been very impressive. Dan, who's the Brummy lad.
Yeah, from my neck of the woods.
Yeah, who's been doing a great deal of Asian-inspired cuisine, I think, based from his travels, and I think his parents or his father, his mother's side is of Chinese heritage, and he's had a real good competition. He's managed to really sort of stamp his tradition and his heritage on a lot of the food that he's cooked. So I met him a few years back before I went out to work in France. We were all based in Courchevel for a couple of weeks of training before we went out to our individual resorts, and he was one of the chefs that, I don't know where it was he ended up working, but yeah, I had a few conversations with him. He seemed like a really nice chap, really driven. It's good to see that, you know, he's gone on to, well, obviously he's going to go on to do greater things now because he's in the final of MasterChef. But yeah, it's nice to sort of think like at one stage, him and I were probably on, you know, on some sort of a par, you would imagine, because we were going for the same types of jobs and the same roles. Obviously, he's gone that way. I've kind of plateaued from there, but yeah, maybe we could get him on one day.
Maybe.
He won't remember who I am, I don't think.
No.
I doubt it very much. But there is one other cooking competition, which is certainly for a professional worth entering and worth getting involved in. And it's something that you...
You've thrown your hat into the ring.
Tell us a bit about that.
So this year, I have entered the Roux Scholarship.
Oh, why do I do these things to myself? Well, you might not have done anything if you're not successful, but...
This is... I have thought about doing it for a few years now, and this year is the last year I can apply before I turn
30.
And that's it. You can't apply after that.
No.
I think they've extended it to 31 this year.
Really?
That's because of last year's
situation.
So this year I have applied for the Roux Scholarship.
Yeah, and for those that don't know what the Roux Scholarship is, give us a bit of background.
The Roux Scholarship's almost 40 now, I think. I think it had 30 years in 2013. 30 years in 2013, yeah. So...
Am I right in thinking that the late, great Andrew Fairley was the first?
Andrew Fairley was, he was a Roux scholar.
Yeah. They include the likes of Simon Halston.
A myriad of
chefs. A few big names.
Yeah, so it was started by Michel and Albert.
Yeah.
Many years ago.
Yeah.
And, I think as a chef, it's probably one of the most, or if not the most prestigious cooking competitions.
Yeah.
I don't know why I did it, but I've done it now.
Yeah.
So I've got to come up with my dishes and put my thinking hat on.
And I suppose you can't give away any information of what it is you'll be doing, but...
No.
It's certainly...
Because I don't want to
give out the scholar applicants. No. But are you allowed to divulge what is the stages of the competition? So where you're at now and...
Yeah, so you apply... I don't have an MVQ level 3, so my employer had sent in a reference. Saying that they'd support me throughout the competition.
Yeah.
And so between now and, I think it's the 31st of January, you've got to come up with a dish with four people.
And you have to give a full recipe.
You have to send in a whole recipe.
Method.
I think costings as well. I haven't really opened the thing yet because I'm still in the thinking stages. Yeah, and then if you're successful in that round, then you go through to the regional finals, where you go and cook your dish and a mystery box dessert usually.
Ooh!
And then if you're successful in that round, which let's be honest, I don't think I will be.
Well, you never know.
You never know. But if you're successful in that round, then you go to the finals.
Yeah.
And
was it 8 or 10 chefs in the final? I've seen in previous years there's a lot of when you get to the final.
I don't think it's that many. I think it's only 6.
Yeah, when you get to the final, they tend to take you places as a group of finalists, don't they?
I'm not sure.
I've seen somewhere. I mean, obviously, as we've discussed, travel.
Yeah.
Implications due to COVID and everything like that may not make that as possible as it once was. But I have seen where they've gone away and seen different restaurants and different chefs.
Maybe
and been away for 3 or 4 days here at a time, and you know, really sort of there's like a collective about it, and then they go. So the final, but...
And then the finals, you know,
yeah.
Traditionally very classical.
Yeah.
Sort of...
It's a challenge dish. That's set by...
There's no machines, there's no toys.
It's a classic dish that's set by Michelle and Alan. And the chefs, the contestants have to recreate, I think, the main... some parts are open to interpretation, but as long as there's, you know, a garnish of X, Y, Z, and then the main part of the dish has to be obviously done exactly how it should.
So last year we lost Albert, Michelle, one of them.
Albert.
The other one. Yeah. And I think last year they did Oaf Albert and like a snail tart, two tarts. Mm. That was the final dish last
year. Real classical. But going back to the ingredient they've given you.
Yeah.
Dover sole. Happy with that one? Like a bit of fish, don't you? Like a bit of
like
seafood.
A bit of fish.
Cookery.
Yeah. Brown shrimps.
Yeah.
Pasta. A sauce.
Sauce.
And another garnish.
Yeah. Pasta. Happy with that?
Could
you've
be worse.
Bit, you've done a bit of pasta.
I've done
We've done a bit of pasta before, so, you know, and that's one of the parts that you said is open to a bit of interpretation, so you can
boil
it.
I had to, you know, double check. You don't want to go into these things and say,
no.
I'm going to make a ravioli of
whatever it might be.
Whatever.
Yeah. And then so you're going to be practicing.
Send that in and they go, well, you're not allowed to do filled, actually.
So you're going to be practicing that over, sort of, once Christmas is out of the way, you've got a couple of weeks to sort of.
Got a couple of weeks to cook that about 30 times.
Yeah, it's nice they picked some fairly inexpensive ingredients for it, like Dover soles. You can get hold of that at a pittance.
Yeah.
And then just cook it up.
But obviously, Sam's a vegetarian, so.
Oh, well, I'll come round for the tasting then. I don't mind. I'll do it for you. I'll help you out.
Yeah.
Well, best of luck with it, Chief.
Thank you. I've dug out a scoffier.
You dug out the... I would. I'd be learning all of the all of the French
names. The trouble is with that very old copy of a scoffier I've got, it's not very... It's very badly translated and it's not very easy to understand.
Yeah.
So I might have to get a copy of...
This is something that we've discussed...
An updated version.
That we've discussed quite a lot before on like... You know, we may have come across it on the podcast, but definitely we discussed it in just general chit chat with a cup of coffee, and it's the sort of skills and techniques and the preparation that they look at and they judge on within the Roux Scholarship and in a way in the MasterChef Professionals as well, that classical technique.
Yeah,
but is that the way that chefs are trained these days? I don't know. It's so old fashioned now that, and I think things have evolved and moved on so much over the last few years that I just think chefs are trained in a different way these days.
Yeah.
I mean, when you go back, I mean, long before you and I started cooking, but when you went back far enough, the suppliers, the ingredients that you got, they wouldn't fillet your fish for you. They wouldn't bone out your leg of lamb for you.
Yeah.
But nowadays you can get all that sort of stuff done. And because, you know, we highlighted earlier on that chefs are under more pressure, perhaps because there's less of them in the team, less of them in the brigade these days. So have you got the time to be stood next to one of your junior chefs and show them how to bone out a leg of lamb or stuff and roll a saddle or whatever?
Yeah.
When you can just get it prepared for you. And I do think... Certainly from a MasterChef Professionals aspect of the show, I almost think in a way that the skills test, if it's of that much of an importance to know that a chef has got what they call their classical chops, to reintroduce that at a later stage back in the competition rather than just having the chefs come in. So I think they could broaden the scope of that. They could broaden the scope of it, almost like... what they do in the Roux Scholarship where the finalists have a dish to recreate.
Yeah.
Whether they can do something like that in the final stages of MasterChef when they get to finals week.
Yeah.
You know, whether Marcus and Monica between the two of them could prepare something, you know, quite classical. But then again, the classical French techniques, for as much as we, you know, as much as we use them, as much as we can use them, not all chefs have those skills.
No.
You know, and ultimately, what are you judging? Are you judging the creativity and ability of a chef to make great food, or is it predicated so much on knowledge of classical French technique? It almost makes whatever skills they have slightly redundant.
Yeah.
Because you just have to say, listen, you're not the type of chef that we're looking for.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You see it a fair bit when you have chefs that come onto those competitions that are from a different background, a non-European background.
Yeah.
And they have lots of technique and lots of skill based around the heritage of their cuisine, but why would they necessarily have much of an idea of French technique when they've come from a different part of the world and they've never really worked in European restaurants? So you're kind of asking them to do something that they wouldn't know how to do.
Yeah.
You know, the same as you and I wouldn't have the first clue about how to make dim sum. Why would we?
Yeah,
you know, it's not the sort of stuff that we cook. We've never been exposed to it. So I don't know. I don't know. Maybe they could tweak it there. But as a whole.
Yeah. I find that sort of ilk of, I don't know. There's always, here's the thing. There's always going to be a time where your supplier sends in the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah,
you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Where, you know, they send in a whole, you know, turbot or whatever.
Yeah.
That you need to break down.
Yeah.
Where you've asked for it to be broken down.
Yeah.
So learning those skills, I think, are quite key.
Yeah.
Just as a buffer.
Yeah.
However way you cook them, whether you pan fry them or you put them in plastic bags, you know, that's not the issue, really. Yeah. I think it's just, you know, the amount of chefs that you see where you're like, can you just break down that fish, a flat fish, and they just take off the top two fillets.
Yeah.
You're like, there's two underneath as well.
Yeah.
But they don't know.
No. I remember I was working in a restaurant in Exeter, and we had on the menu the classic sole meunier, so it's pan-fried lemon, caper, butter, and one of the customers said, oh, can you fillet the fish? And I wasn't on the fish section this particular night, and there was a young chef on there, and he hadn't long been out of college, only a couple of years, and he had no idea what to do.
Yeah.
And he came over to me on the meeting, going, can you fillet this fish for me? And I was thinking, of any of us, like, you would have been doing this only 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
You know? So I did it for him, and I was just thinking, like, that's the sort of thing, you're absolutely right, that you should know how to do.
Yeah.
I think. And it's very easy for us to sit here and with a cup of tea and spout about being absolutely proficient in every aspect of cookery. And I'm guilty of it. I'll sit there and watch people on the skills test and be like, Jesus Christ, you've really made a hash of that. But if I was in that scenario, I reckon I'd probably be bricking it so much that I'd probably use the wrong end of the knife. So
here's the trouble with the skills test, though, is that they're so nervous going into those skills tests that, you know, I don't see what it brings to the table.
Mm.
That you work yourself up so much to go in there and, you know, chefs work well under pressure. Yeah, I understand that. And I understand that they want to see what you're like under pressure.
Yeah.
But I just don't understand what that brings to the table other than us laughing at them at home.
Well, I think potentially that could be the part of the show that draws in, should we say, like the non-culinarily inclined viewer that just wants to see someone potentially embarrass themselves making a crepe Suzette or something like that.
But you make yourself look like a dickhead.
Yeah, but
that's career suicide.
Which is also why I think it might be better to bring it back in at a later stage in the competition, because then the chefs don't have the excuse of not knowing the kitchen, being nervous. You know, they got to it. Well, it's still going to be some kind of nerves because they're in an advanced stage of the competition, but they haven't got those excuses anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And then we're going back to, okay, you've shown us what you can do up to this point. Now I want you to do something particular. I want to know that you still know.
Or they start off doing their own signature dish.
Yeah.
And then maybe move into the skills test afterwards.
Yeah, possibly.
Because you sort of, you're cooking what you know then.
Yeah. But I'll be sending all these little bits of critique into the powers that be at the BBC, and with a bit of luck, maybe they'll change the format of the show based on what two idiots from Devon have to think about it. Who knows? But maybe if you were to go and do us a favour of winning the Roos Scholarship, that might carry a little bit more clout. They might listen to you then.
Maybe,
and then I'll just be
maybe I'll apply for that.
I'll just be hanging on to your coattails, coming along for the ride.
Not yourself,
that's all right, mate. Yeah, but anyway, that's been a nice little strange respite through the crazy times. Is the continuity of MasterChef Professionals, a show that you've applied for before.
And didn't get on. Let's move on.
So if anyone's watching from BBC, get him on there. But talking of Christmas, Christmas lunch for you.
Yeah.
What's the big nose and what's the big must-haves? Because everyone's got, seen them flying around Instagram, polls going up left, right and centre about, you know, what do you need on a Christmas lunch? What's the best part? What's the worst part? What's the best part for you of a Christmas lunch? Probably someone else cooking for you, I'd imagine, is the nice bit.
Family. What a corny family. Do you know what? Actually,
yeah.
Over the years, I've eaten some fucking awful Christmas dinners.
Don't doubt it.
And actually, it is being with people that you like.
Yeah, yeah.
Dare I say love?
Dare you say love?
Yeah, I think that's a big attraction for Christmas.
Yeah. Is it always the same thing for you? Is it traditional? Is it round to parents' house? Is it always roast turkey? Is it always this, or is it change up?
My dad doesn't eat turkey because he's a fussy man. So usually beef.
Beef?
At theirs, yeah.
Yeah, bit of slow-cooked beef or a bit of rare or something. Oh.
sorry, Mum. Yeah, so they usually have beef. Always Christmas pudding. I don't see the appeal of it myself.
No, I've never been a big fan of Christmas pudding.
Or a trifle. When my grandparents were alive, it was always like a trifle.
Yeah. My mum has traditionally knocked up a trifle every year.
Yeah, and I'd always prefer that because...
Yeah.
You can eat more. you can eat more of that.
You know your way around a trifle. I love trifle. I think it's great. I think there's so much you can do with it as a dish.
Yeah.
The fundamentals, obviously.
We've got trifles jelly, on menus.
Cream. Yeah, I think they're great. We've had one on the Christmas menu here over at the pub, and it's been a pretty decent seller.
I'll tell you what I did see.
I can't take any credit for it, though, because it wasn't my idea. Well, my idea to say let's have a trifle, but I didn't conceptualise the dish from start to finish.
A deconstructed trifle.
You've had one of them, have you?
No, I saw one the other day on one of the social medias.
You have a bit of a problem with deconstructed stuff, don't you?
What the fuck are we doing? The idea of having a
pudding,
trifle.
Yeah, you know this pudding that sits nicely in a glass, everything layered? Let's fucking tip it out and put it all across a plate. Yeah. What a waste of time.
Why are we doing that?
I have no idea. No idea. Deconstructed cheesecakes, they can fuck off as well. No time for them.
Think of anyone in particular there?
Well,
we can cut that out.
I mean, it's just... Unless you can guarantee it's going to be better than how it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing with a wonderfully made trifle or a wonderfully made cheesecake or whatever it might be. Unless you can guarantee to me it's going to be better than how it's originally supposed to be, why dick around with it?
You know... Here's the thing.
Yeah.
A trifle,
which
some people might think easy, is actually quite a complex thing.
It's quite a tricky thing.
Because you've got to have the right amount of jelly.
Yeah.
You can't have too much custard or cream.
And it's got to be set right.
It's got to set. You've got to have the biscuits in the bottom.
Yeah.
Ladies' fingers, whatever you like.
Whatever you like.
It's actually a very complicated
thing. How many hundreds and thousands to sprinkle on the top?
That's right.
Need to count them out. Hundreds. Exactly. Exactly. A question for you. I mean, we just discussed about... things we don't like. If you were to be cooking a Christmas lunch, like what would be on the plate and what would be on the table for you? Start with your meat. Would you go traditional?
Definitely turkey.
Yeah, you'd do that?
Yeah, because I can cook turkey.
Yeah. A whole bird?
Probably just a crown breast, take the breast off.
Yeah. Roast it on the crown, yeah?
Yeah, roll it probably.
Oh.
I used to do in bacon.
Oh, okay. So you take it all off, open it out.
Yeah.
Stuff
zest.
It.
Zest.
Yeah, so what would be going in? So just to give people a bit of an idea, so you'd be taking the breast off the crown.
Yeah.
And then from there...
Open it out.
Open it out, so it's like a nice
flat
kind of sheet. Yeah.
Loads of chopped herbs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like?
Parsley, chives, tarragon.
Tarragon.
Yeah, just a little bit of that. And some zest, orange, lemon.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit of lime. Who knows?
Yeah.
Then roll it back up with...
into a nice long sausage.
Into a sausage with bacon streaky.
Streaky bacon wrapped around the outside.
Yeah. Tinfoil, roast that.
Yeah.
And then once that's cooked, take that off. Another sort of 10 minutes just to crisp up the bacon because I'd keep that.
Yeah.
And then just slice off there.
Yeah. Makes it easier for portions as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And it's the sort of thing that
if I could, I'd do that the day before.
Yeah.
So it cools down, it's cold, slice it and then just reheat.
You hear many... chefs around Christmas time and they're on the TV and whatnot, and they're all saying about the stuff you can get ahead, and it sounds like a bit of a broken record, but it is so much of a necessity.
Yeah.
Because, as well, like the equipment you're using, the stove you've got at home, the little oven you've got, you get these people, and my mum somehow has done it, you know, for all of our lives, like cooked a roast dinner for 12, 13, 14, 15 people from a tiny oven, minimal hob space. And it is because she gets well ahead on things.
Yeah,
that's how you can make it happen.
Unlike someone
Yeah.
who gets up at fucking 4 a.m. on Christmas morning.
Yeah.
To go get the turkey in. and you got to piss around with the potatoes.
Yeah.
Nothing's peeled, nothing's ready.
No.
You could learn a lot as a home cook
yeah.
from a chef about getting prepared.
Yeah. Yeah. That's often the thing that really sort of separates the home cook from the professional chef. It's just yeah. the organisation of things and knowing what you can get ahead of time. The big one's roast potatoes.
Yeah.
And your veggies, get them blanched off the day before.
Yeah.
You know, roasties are always better when they're cold and they're properly dry and then you can really chuck them in. Don't crowd too many roasties in your tray. That's the big one. Get them yeah. all nice and hot, but don't cram them in so they're packed all nice and tight. And don't salt them too early because then they'll start to release their moisture and they'll just boil and you won't get the nice crispy potato that everybody wants yeah. at Christmas time. If you have to roast them in two batches, roast them in two batches, because if you're prepared ahead of time, you know, you've got your bird cooked, it's resting, let that rest for hours. You've got hot gravy to warm it up with. You don't need to be doing the meat last. Get that in first. When you get yeah. up in the morning, if you've got a whole turkey, whatever, you know, it's going to take 3.5 hours to cook, get it in. Get it in. Get it cooked. Make sure it's well looked after. Get it out. And then you've got 2.5 hours while that bird is resting in oven
rest
space
it properly,
to do two batches it. Of roast potatoes, pigs yeah. and blankets on a tray, whatever it is you need to do. But if you're having turkey, or you're having goose, or you're having pork, some people like pork for Christmas, it's great. You're having some fish, whatever, but particularly with the roast meat. If I see anybody, if I see anybody put in a Yorkshire pudding with anything other than beef, I'm lose my mind. It's bad enough on a Sunday where I work that we offer Yorkshire puddings with every roast meat option that we do. Roast beef and Yorkshire puddings,
yeah.
that's it.
Yeah.
That's it. That's what it goes with. That's what it's there for. If you want an extra Yorkshire pudding, order one. Just say, can I have one with me chicken or lamb or whatever it might be. But Yorkshire puddings with a Christmas dinner for me is a big no-no. Unless it's beef.
Quite controversially.
Yeah.
I fucking hate roast dinners.
You hate roast dinners?
Yeah. I hate cooking them. I hate eating them.
Yeah.
I just hate them. I hate the whole thing about... I don't understand what they're about.
No. No.
There's no refining a roast dinner, really.
No, I don't like... you shouldn't try.
I just fucking hate them. And if I never have to see one again for the rest of my life, I'll be a happy chap.
Well, you'll be pumping out quite a few where you work, won't you?
Yeah.
I mean, we're busy enough where we are.
But I've always hated them. And also, and I don't know why this is, Sundays bring out the worst fucking people.
Mm.
Just arrogant.
The real man.
Stuck up. Oh, my mum does better. Well, fucking stay at home and have a cook.
Yeah. Well, that's always what I said is, and people who know me would have heard me say this before because I am culpable of sounding like a broken record, but Christmas time is the most difficult time to cook for other people, particularly with it being a roast dinner, because you are competing against the one thing you can seldom defeat, and that is nostalgia.
Mum's.
You'll never beat mum's roast, nan's roast, granddad's roast potatoes are the best, you know, dad does the best turkey, and you just can't compete against that. And sometimes you're on a real hiding to nothing. I always hark back to a story of when I was cooking in France in the chalet a few years back. And it's not just, you know, not just with Christmas. People get sentimental about food. People are very sentimental about a lot of things. And I made a fish pie for dinner for the people in the chalet one evening. You know, I did as best a job as I possibly could. And there was one of the guests there that was eating, and he stopped me at the end of dinner. He went, "Oh, that fish pie was just as good as my granddad's. Not quite as good, but almost as good." And I said, "All right, what did your granddad do with his?" And he went, "He just put some mustard and a shitload of cream in it. But I tell you what, yours was nearly as good." And I'm thinking, what's the point here? Like, you know, mustard and a shitload of cream, or shitload of mustard and some cream is what he said. And that was it.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter what you're trying to do,
but
the type of fish that I might have used, the fact that I made a, you know, fish stock and, you know, reduced it and added it, you know, into a velouté kind of sauce to bind all the fish together and, you know, didn't matter.
Yeah.
Didn't matter because it didn't have granddad's shitload of mustard and some cream in there. Just boiled the fish up for hours. And that's what you're competing against. It can make it.
We're having technical difficulties.
Can make it very, very difficult.
We can have a light on here. Oh, no, because I can't, because that's all.
No. I'll just pause it, you know.
There's no other plugs over there.
But anyway, that's enough ranting about fish pies and challenging nostalgia. I believe you've got a question.
Yeah, we've got out on Instagram about Christmas episode questions. Jason's come flying back through again with a few, actually. We can go through all of them. We've got time. It's Christmas, isn't it? Have a mulled wine and answer some of these. Cooking at Christmas /with the family, is it a chef's heaven or hell?
Well... I've done a few Christmas lunches for the family. The most recent one was, I think, 3 years ago. But a lot of the time, you don't have the time to do it because you're busy, because you're working right the way up through. So you haven't really got the time to do, just to simply to do it. I mean, unless you come home from work Christmas Eve night and then start cracking on with stuff. But at the end of a long day, which is a busy day like Christmas Eve, you don't want to be coming home and peeling some spuds. But yeah, I did it a couple of years ago for Harriet and her family. Harriet is my fiance, for those that don't know, and her family. There's a few of them down. I think it was about 12 of us all together. And I had no time to sort of get any gifts or anything like that. So I said, listen, for the family, it's a Christmas present. I'll, you know, borrow the produce and cook it all up. You tell me what you want and I'll go and get it. Which had its challenges, obviously.
Was that one of the best or worst presents she's ever received?
You'd have to ask her, really. I did get her a guitar one Christmas, so it's probably going to be below that, I'd imagine. No, I mean, I don't mind it. I don't mind it because, like you say, you're prepared, you're ready. So I would say for me, it's not much of an issue. I don't mind doing it. I don't think I'm definitely not doing it this year. I didn't do it last year. But if I had the time to do it again, I wouldn't mind doing it. It's not a big issue for me. No, I mean,
heaven or hell.
No, I'm fairly indifferent about it, really. I mean, you would like to say that you would think if you were cooking Christmas dinner, it would be
the best.
At least, well, the best, but at least some way decent, you would hope. It'd be the worst thing to do a Christmas lunch for the friends and family.
Yeah.
And have it be one of the worst they've ever had. It may make you want to rethink your professional inclinations. But yeah, for me, I'm fairly indifferent about it, to be honest. I'm a bit like you. I just like being around at Christmas time with the family, with Harriet's family, my family, and just having some food on the table prepared for you. That's you know, one of my hobbies is going out to eat because I like people cooking for me. It's nice, you know. Yeah. I like to be on the other side of it and, you know, experience a decent meal, a decent service. But yeah, what about you? Have you done it?
I have done it. Not for a long time though. No.
Did it go well?
Yeah.
Do you remember what you made?
Yeah, beef Wellington.
Oh no!
I was going through a beef Wellington stage in my life.
Yeah, we've all done that.
Any function or whatever family do, I'll make a Wellington.
Wrap it in pastry.
You know, I find cooking for that small amount of people actually quite boring.
Yeah.
And actually quite tedious. So it's not something that I enjoy doing, really.
So it's certainly a bit more of
and
a
actually,
hell for you.
You know, you cook 364 days of the year. Mm. Cooking one day off is nice. But I hate cooking on my days off.
But cooking for Sam, your partner, she's vegetarian. So
she's vegetarian.
So what is she going to have at Christmas?
Well, she's only been vegetarian for sort of 2 or 3 years.
Mm. So she has a day off at Christmas and just smashes a load of turkey down her face.
Yeah, yeah. We did Veganuary 2019, I think.
Mm.
Or Veggie January, actually, because there's no way I could give up cheese.
Nope.
And the amount of tea that I drink.
Yeah.
I need milk. So we did Veggie January. And I nearly got to the end of January and I give up because work.
Yeah.
I need to be able to eat meat.
Yeah.
What does she have on Christmas Day? I'm not really sure because last year I was working.
No, Christmas Day.
Christmas Day at the care home. And the year before that, I can't remember. I don't think she was vegetarian then, actually.
No. Have you got any idea what she's having this year?
No.
No. But she will be joining you for Christmas.
Just plates of vegetables.
Plates of vegetables.
Cauliflower
just
cheese.
No meat roast, yeah.
Yeah.
Is cauliflower cheese a thing for Christmas dinner in your family?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we love cheese.
So I'll tell you the one thing that's...
Because we're all fat fucks.
So I'll tell you the Christmas tradition or the roast tradition in our family, and this does divide opinion. And people may think it's hypocritical that I went off on having Yorkshire puddings with any other meat other than beef. But it's something that we've always had with any roast.
Mm.
And it's still there at Christmas time. I don't know where it comes from or why it even started. But it's mushy peas.
Is it?
Mushy peas with a roast dinner.
What the fuck is going on here?
And we love it. It's always been done. Mum's always done mushy peas with pretty much every roast, but always at Christmas time.
Does she need psychiatric attention?
It's still more she made. Well, I can't be the one.
Where's this one
on
come from?
I don't know, but it's the one Christmas tradition that we've always had. And when I mention it to certain people, they look at me with disgust, absolute disdain that I'll be having mushy peas with a roast dinner. But I like it.
That's your choice.
I am telling people not to have a Yorkshire pudding with some roast pork. But stick some mushy peas on there.
Yeah.
Good ones. Change your life.
Marifat.
Oh, get them on there, mate. Yeah.
Wow.
Dried peas, soak them overnight, bit of bicarb.
I'll try that.
Yeah, get it on
there. Maybe that's what she could have for Christmas Day.
Mushy peas.
Mushy peas, fritters.
They'd love her in Norfolk. Yeah. That's all they eat up there.
Yeah.
Mushy peas.
Vinegar.
Yeah. What's the next one?
Favourite Boxing Day leftover meal?
Favourite Boxing Day. Well, we would just sort of have like cold meat platters. It was never really like a particular meal that we did, not like a turkey curry or anything like that. So just be cold meat platters. So the leftover, Mum would normally do like a ham at Christmas and any leftover beef or whatever, or turkey, just sliced nice and thin, bit of chutney, some cheeses and bread and biscuits kicking around. That's all we'd really do. I don't really want to cook on Boxing Day if I'm off on Boxing Day.
No.
You just want to pick out what you've got there.
Yeah.
Minimum kind of prep or fuss. I don't want to be in there making a pie.
Yeah. I think as a child, I don't think we had many leftovers.
I can tell.
So I don't think we ever really had leftover meals.
No.
Bubble and squeak, maybe?
Bubble and squeak in the morning. Or
my mum,
yeah,
if we had beef left over, would like heat it up in a gravy and then we'd have it with like chips or something. Like it wasn't leftover Boxing Day, wasn't really a thing in our house.
No. I do remember having bubble and squeak in the morning for breakfast. So a couple of rashers
my
of
dad
bacon,
would do that.
Bubble and squeak and a fried egg
my
or
dad's
something
job,
like that.
If there was any.
No, my dad doesn't do any cooking over Christmas. It's not allowed.
I don't think we ever did. And now I only buy what we need.
Yeah.
So
I know there was a tradition in Harriet's family where her dad on Boxing Day would make a dish called turkey a la king.
Right.
I've never seen it. I'd never heard of it. I think it was just turkey cooked down in like a brandy kind of cream sauce. And I don't know if it was served with rice or something. I'm not sure. Or any leftover roast potatoes. But they all say it was fucking revolting. And since I've been around, I've never had the pleasure of tasting it. Her father is adamant that when done right, It's quite a delicious dish.
What about Marco's turkey curry with
Marco's turkey curry
bananas?
Bananas. Yeah, I mean, for people that don't know, you can check it out on YouTube of Marco Pierre White, the great Marco Pierre White, making a turkey curry with bananas and
blended up bananas
and stick some pineapple in there as well.
I think he does.
And some. I mean, it sounds pretty grim.
Yeah. I mean, far be it from me to...
For all we know, it tastes delicious, but yeah, certainly nothing that happened in our family.
No.
A turkey curry.
No. No.
Not. I mean, I wouldn't say no to it, but it's never been done.
Yeah.
I'm always working Boxing Day anyway, so...
Yeah. Lastly from Jason, is turkey just for Christmas? I know dogs aren't, but
dogs aren't
turkeys.
No. It is whether you like it or not. Really, I mean, people tend not to utilize it.
Would you put turkey on the menu in August?
No, because it's not at its best. It's not. It just isn't the season for turkey at Christmas time.
If rearing times were changed, so you could buy turkey in August.
I think you have to look at what's available, what's in season, what's at its best. Certainly, I would have no problem at all, and even probably will, use turkey after Christmas, January, you know, into February. But it is that kind of small window of, you know, turkey's kind of November through till the end of December, and then that's it. You don't see it again. It's often been described as the kind of one-hit wonder of the culinary world.
Yeah.
It's a bit like the Chesney Hawks of protein.
Turkey Twizzlers,
well, yeah. But I'd have no problem. I mean, turkey's a tricky meat. It is because they're so big, for one.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there is obviously things that you can do with them. I mean, it'd be quite nice to cut thin slices off of the breast, or even thicker chunks, and pound it out and do like little turkey escallops and things like that. It'd be quite nice to do. Like you said with your roast turkey, how you take the whole breast off the crown and wrap it. You could do smaller versions of that, little ballotines and bits and pieces. It'd be quite nice. The leg meat can be, you know, like any leg meat from a bird, can be slow cooked or confit and then picked and rolled into, or put, you know, placed in a tureen, or you can ball them up and make little fritters out of them and fry them and serve them with whatever you like, a bit of chutney or whatever, something that's going to go nice with it. I think it's a shame because it is, you know, good quality turkey. It's a tasty bird, you know. I mean, it's delicate in its flavour. You've got to be careful what you do with it, particularly the breast meat, because you can overpower it. You know, all these stories of turkey meat being so lean, it dries out very quickly. So it just takes a little bit of considerate, careful cooking, doesn't it? But, you know, I'd happily use turkey.
Do you think you'd be, if you could get turkey all year round, which I'm sure you probably can, but not English, would you, do you think you'd be considered weird having turkey on the menu in the summer months?
Probably, I would say. But then again, there's other places in the world. I mean, look at the Americans. I mean, partly because turkey's probably much more abundant over there. It's where turkey comes from. It's why we eat turkey, because it was brought over from across the pond. But they put turkey in everything. I mean, they put it in sandwiches. I mean, they're a nation of sandwich lovers, and turkey in their sandwiches is perfectly fine. But yeah, you probably, we just favour chicken, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, so.
I like a chicken.
Yeah, it would probably be something that'd be looked at a little bit weird, but if you could get hold of it. I mean, it was difficult for this Christmas even getting hold of as much turkey as normal. Goose, I wanted to put that on the menu, but that was so hard to come by because people, the suppliers weren't knowing what was going to happen with the trade. So they were expecting potential lockdowns. They hedged their bets. Pardon me, the hatcheries weren't producing as many goslings as far as geese go. And the same with turkey. There's not as much around as what there was before because the suppliers were hedging their bets on, you know, not having the trade to supply. So it's difficult to get hold of. But if you could get hold of it any other time of year, I think you should use it, really.
Yeah.
You know?
Just from a sustainability
point of view.
Yeah.
And turkey eggs as well. You ever used a turkey egg?
No, I don't think I have.
No.
Too big.
Somebody broached the subject with me a couple of weeks back. I don't think I've even seen a turkey egg.
No.
I wonder what they look like.
Large eggs.
Large eggs is probably correct. Yeah, very astute assessment. But yeah, why couldn't you use those?
Yeah.
Scrambling, frying, poaching, whatever it might be. But yeah, no, I don't think turkey should be just for Christmas, but I think sadly it just is. It's just one of those things. It's tradition.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's the time of year. Break tradition.
Fuck it.
Sob tradition. No, I'm quite traditional with certain things, and other things I'm not too concerned about.
Yeah.
But certainly I think after Christmas, people should still be using turkey. For sure.
I don't think I ate turkey till I was probably 15 when I joined the RAF. 16 maybe.
Any reason?
Well, my dad doesn't eat turkey.
No. So he just never had it in.
So we never had it for Christmas. And then, I left home at, 15 and a half, 16.
Yeah.
I was in the RAF, and I was like, I wonder what it's like.
Yeah.
So I tried turkey. Do you know what? It doesn't really blow me away. Like, I'd rather a chicken, I think.
Yeah, I just think sometimes it's a lot of these things. I think it just needs rebranding somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, you've seen it happen with different produce. Fish, for example. Silver mullet. Used to be called grey mullet.
Yeah.
Megrim sole. Ugly looking flat fish. Sometimes it's referred to as Cornish sole. Just to try and help sort of push it along. And turkey, just by its own name, sounds extremely underwhelming. So I don't know how they're going to, you know, you can't change the name of the bird, it's called what it's called. But, you know, perhaps push the fact that it's a, you know, a bronze turkey or whatever it might be. Let's try and add something to it to give it a little bit more sort of widespread appeal. But perhaps people don't use it so much other than just on the Christmas day because perhaps they don't really know what to do with it.
Yeah.
That could be it.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know.
But I like going back to tradition, I think traditionally turkey is dry is a thing that I hear quite a lot. And, you know, serving a moist turkey is a rarity in the domestic household.
Yeah. I think if it was me, if I was to be cooking a certainly like a crown, like roasted on the crown, if I had the space to do it at home and I could, you know, I could make sure it would be done, my tip would be to brine it.
Yeah.
I'd brine the whole thing.
Just keep going.
Yeah, so I'd brine the whole thing. So you'd be looking at, it's basically a brine will help just hold in the moisture into the bird. So it's essentially like a salt water solution. So it's a percentage of the water volume is made up with salt. So, you know, like for instance, like a 10% brine would be whatever amount of liquid you've got in there, 10% of that is salt. Then you flavour it with any aromats that you like. You know, so Christmas time, you'd be looking at things like star anise, some black peppercorns, orange zest, thyme, garlic, things like that, and let it sit in there for an amount of time that it can permeate through the skin, and that will help you to then maintain
a moist
bird coming in to cook it. And you know, we do a lot of that at the pub, particularly with leaner pieces of meat, particularly chicken as well, just to help it. So it means you can cook it a little bit more.
Yeah, you've got that little...
And it still holds... And
you've got a buffer almost.
And the texture changes as well. It firms it up and it gives it more of a pleasant mouthfeel. Because you get overcooked chicken or overcooked turkey, it's got that kind of graininess that just doesn't feel that nice in the mouth once it's overcooked. And it is a bit more forgiving stringy once you brined it. Don't leave it in there too long. It will just taste like salt-cured turkey no matter what you do to it, and that won't be very pleasant, but... Yeah, I think sadly turkey, unless it has a real rebrand.
Yeah,
you know, it's going to be the forever one hit wonder
Christmas
bird. Well, the Christmas bird, which is
thanks
a
for them.
Bit of a shame, but yeah, cheers, Jason.
Jason, that was,
hope you're cooking your turkey very well this year.
I'm sure you will be.
We went there, didn't we?
We did go there actually. We should talk about
that. To the galley in Topsham.
Yeah,
We went for a lovely lunch.
Yeah,
three-course lunch. Yeah, very good. I think if anyone's in and around the area that wants to have what I would consider to be a quick lunch. I mean, we had three courses.
Just over an hour.
The place was busy, and we were there for just over an hour. We had three courses. Everything was cooked with care. All the plates looked really nice, you know, presented in a real kind of... Change the battery.
I don't think I've got a battery. Are we recording again?
Of course, we'll go back to the galley, Topsham. I'll start off with that.
Has that moved?
Bit further out on it, I think.
That's about right. Get you into shot, Chief. There we go. That right?
Out a bit more if we get you in.
That'll do. We're recording.
Yeah, so...
Just before, if this looks different now, we just had some camera-related battery issues, so...
Yeah.
But you're all right.
Professional to the last. So if anyone is in and around the Topsham area...
Yeah.
Get yourself across there.
Definitely go and check them out.
Yeah. Good, solid cookery. No frills. You know, everything was on the plate for a reason. Everything was cooked with care. It looks smart. You know, Jason's a good chef, good guy. Got a good team in there as well. And it's a nice little restaurant. It's nice.
Very nice. Yeah,
nice little atmosphere, nice little buzz about it. And I think we went on a Tuesday lunchtime, end of November. Place was pretty full.
Every table.
So they're doing a good trade. So, yeah, can't really speak highly enough of that place. Right, Chief. Final part. I thought with it being Christmas... Normally we do a challenge, Chief, and it's, you know, something for you to get your head around, you know, a quiz or whatever. And what I thought I'd do this time around, because it's Christmas.
It is Christmas.
It's not necessarily culinary related, but it's a Christmas true or false. 10 questions.
Oh, shit.
Christmas true or false. So, challenge, Chief. Christmas special. Here we go. Rattle them off nice and quick. Number one, St. Nicholas's coat was traditionally green before Coca-Cola changed it to red in an advertising campaign. You're going with true.
Yeah.
That is correct. That is true.
Yeah.
Question two. In Wiltshire, in the 18th century, large rocks were brought into the home and decorated instead of Christmas trees.
I mean, I can imagine something like that going on in Norfolk. So.
Wiltshire.
Wiltshire, yeah. So I'd say that's true.
That's actually false.
Yeah. Sorry,
Wiltshire.
Norfolk as well.
Three, in the medieval ages, it was traditional to offer strings of aged sausages as Christmas presents to the elderly. True or false?
Well, I would like some sausages, so I'd say true.
Yeah, it's false.
Yeah.
Unlucky. Four, mince pies used to contain real meat.
False.
That's true.
Of course it is.
Five, red-nosed reindeer are a rare breed of reindeer from Finland with noses covered in tapetum lucidum, a reflective layer of tissue that makes their noses appear to glow red in the dark. True or false?
I'd say that's probably true.
That's false.
Amazing.
Of course it is. Six, the three kings were actually queens. True or false?
False.
That is false.
Yeah.
That's a load of rubbish. Seven, eggnog doesn't actually contain egg.
True.
That's false.
Yeah.
It does contain
I don't
egg.
Drink, so...
No, no. Eight, Switzerland is credited as starting the Christmas tree tradition. True or false?
True.
That's false.
Amazing.
Germany was credited with starting the tradition. Number nine, the first Christmas markets of St. Petersburg, Russia, only sold hats.
True.
True or false?
True.
True, that's false. You've done very well here. And finally, ten... Christmas wreaths are a symbol of Christ. True or false?
False.
That's true.
Amazing.
So I think it's safe to say that as far as Christmas true or false quizzes go, that's definitely not your forte.
No.
So maybe, well, you've got 12 months to prepare for the next one.
Next, the same one.
The same
I'll
one.
I'll forget the answer.
I'll just do them again. 50-50 shot in the dark. Right, I think that brings us to the end, Chief.
Yeah.
I think it started on quite a, I don't know, a low, depressing note. Obviously having to comment and talk about the COVID scenario and how it could potentially impact hospitality going forward. With a bit of luck, I'm hoping everyone's going to make it through all right. But then we moved on to some brighter notes. Hopefully we've shared our dislike for certain things Christmassy and our like for certain things Christmassy.
Have we bought Christmas cheer to the masses?
I doubt it. I don't think many people are thinking, I could do it with some Christmas cheer. Let's listen to these two fat idiots harp on about all sorts of nonsense for an hour. But you never know, it might be someone's bag. But yeah, if anything you'd like to add finally, Chief,
I just want to thank everybody for watching. And I also want to thank everybody for the support that they've given us over the last
X amount of months,
10 months with this crap that we've been doing.
We have.
That we've spent a lot of money on equipment and things.
But hopefully, as the new year comes in, we might find a bit more time to at least give an offering every month or couple of weeks.
Yeah. I'd also like to wish you and all of our listeners and viewers a very happy Christmas.
Yeah, season's
and
greetings.
A fruitful
to you all.
2022.
And whatever you feed yourselves or have fed to you, just remember, someone slaved over that for a few hours.
Yeah.
So be bloody grateful, even if it does suck.
Yeah.
All right, and if you're going to moan...
Unless there's Yorkshire puddings on there, then not yourself.
Yeah, get some mushy peas on the plate. that's all we need to clear up, really. And if you are going to have a moan about someone's cooking behind their back, at least have the balls to offer up cooking the following year.
Yeah.
If you think you can do better, do better. If not, as my mum would say, sit up, shut up and eat up. There we go.
What a
woman.
What a way to end.
Absolutely, yeah. But yeah, thanks again for listening. Thanks to you, Chief.
Thank you.
Have a lovely Christmas. Enjoy your beef.
I will.
Yeah. And hopefully we'll see you all again in the new year. Cheerio.